Well, I noticed we picked up on this expression, light is sweet, in our reflections. And it just goes to show that not everything in Ecclesiastes is bad. There are lots of good things in it too. And Lynn put her finger on it as well when she talked about the salsa classes. The other day I was in Oxford Street, sitting in Prêt à Manger, people watching. As I mentioned this to Ian earlier on. Let me explain. I've brought a group of 28 Spanish kids with me, and they love shopping on Oxford Street. I can't stand it, so I sit and drink a coffee and watch people passing by. And when you're preparing sermons, and one of the key words that comes back and back is meaningless futility, and you see people wandering back and forth with no apparent aim or design, then it brought the message home to me. Another one that was good, we were on the London Eye, and this guy was explaining to us about the fact that the bell tower of the Palace of Westminster is leaning. Did you know that? In about 20 years' time, it'll be leaning as much as the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And he said, well, if they don't do something about it soon, it might fall on top of the Houses of Parliament and kill all the politicians. He said, wouldn't that be terrible? That reminded me of the tree. The tree can fall in any direction. We just don't know. And three things I must say before I begin. First of all, congratulations on this beautiful new building that you have. I love it. And I hear that the Lord is blessing you through it already. And I pray and hope that he continues to do that. Secondly, I'd like to convey the greetings of our home church back in Spain, in Valladolid. I know some of you know one or two of the members of that church, and one or two members of our church remember you dearly. We're very different churches, but it's great because we're all God's children and we can all share in his word and in his praise in the same ways. And thirdly, thank you for this invitation to preach. I've asked one or two of you to give me your honest opinion afterwards. because again, I think the way you do things here at Saldusford is slightly different from the way we do things back home. And for me, it's always a learning curve to come here and always a privilege to speak to you. So I hope you receive blessing from this evening's message. I've been asked to wrap it up, so to speak. I'd just like to give a brief resume of one or two of the key points and then move on to the final two chapters. Ecclesiastes begins talking about the words of the preacher, I think, in our version. It's the words of the teacher. The word in Hebrew, which is kolet, can mean teacher, preacher. It also can mean an official in the government. And later on in the book, Kohelet refers to himself as the king, which is why sometimes this book is attributed to Solomon. But in any case, whoever he is, Kohelet, he's a man of wisdom, great intelligence, and a man of authority. So we do well to pay attention to his words. Some of the key expressions that crop up again and again in the book, in older versions, vanity of vanities, this question of meaninglessness, pointlessness. In the Hebrew, the word also means just a vapor or a breath, and that refers to the brevity of life as well. It's almost over just as it begins. Also the expression under the sun. Everything in this life, our humanity, our mortality in comparison to God's magnificence and eternity. Under the sun makes us think of labor and toil. And here in Britain, this past couple of weeks, you've had some serious sunshine, and you know how hard things get when it gets really hot. Played a few games of tennis the other day, nearly passed out, and thought, well, do people here know about sunstroke? Because it's a real possibility in this weather. Another expression is chasing after the wind. That also refers to pointlessness, doesn't it? There's no point in chasing after the wind. You can't do it. But it also speaks of our frustration. Because God has written immortality in our hearts. It's there, and we see we haven't got it. And it frustrates us. Lynn put her finger on the point just before when she mentioned the fact that it seems like a book that's talking about the meaningless of life for non-believers, and that's absolutely true. And I think it's a point that Coelette is trying to make. But well, more of that later on. Some of the under the sun activities that he mentions, he focuses on the world of work. He says work is a good thing, but too much of it is a bad thing. He focuses on wealth. He said having money is good. It's better to be rich than to be poor. But if you're just earning money to earn it up, to earn it and hoard it, then it's pointless as well. He focuses on wisdom. He says being wise is better than being foolish. But then even wisdom brings sadness. It brings frustration. It brings problems as well. He focuses on pleasures. He tried out everything. But after a while, that becomes pointless also. And in the final two chapters, we see also that he focuses on age. Being young is better than being old. But even being young has its complications. And I think what Coelette is saying to us is this what life is all about? Is there nothing else? He gives us this secular vision. Life without God, this is what it is. He's challenging us. Do any of these things of themselves and in themselves lead to fulfillment in life? Do they take us anywhere? Do they give meaning to our existence? And if you think they do, he whacks you right back in the face by saying, well, you're going to die. Even if it does mean something to you, one day you're going to die and then it's not going to mean anything at all. So the concept of death is clearly used to prove the pointlessness of putting your trust in work, wealth, wisdom out. Work, wealth, wisdom, and then I ran out of W's. So pleasures, a whale of a time. And I got onto age and I couldn't think of anything beginning with a W there. Sorry. The concept of death is clearly used to prove the pointlessness of putting your trust in these things. But just when you think that Coelette, the writer of Ecclesiastes, isn't interested in God and he just wants to give us a secular vision, God surfaces here and there. And he mentions the Lord. He mentions our Creator, God the maker of everything. And when we come to his final comment, God is absolutely key. So, why does he talk about pointlessness so much? Hopefully, we'll be able to answer that question a little bit later on. In the final two chapters, Coelette keeps on talking about deep shadows with occasional highlights. But now, rather than being wistful, we become resolute. We know what the worst is. And since we know what the worst is, now is time to strike out in the right direction. There are three separate thrusts to the end of the matter. So I've got 3 points for you. One is to be bold. Another is to be joyful. And finally, be holy. It's a bit like Warren Wiersbe's B series. And this follows on from chapter 10, where Coelette is telling us to be sensible. He's giving us advice and information on the woes of foolishness. And now in 11, it's time for caution to give way to enterprise. After the frustrating observation of chapter 9, verse 11, which says this, I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. It's frustrating. Time and chance can overthrow our finest plans. And we can react in one or two ways. We can be paralyzed by that and do nothing, or we can be spurred to action, which is what Coelette wants us to do. If there are risks in everything, it's better to fail trying, launching out, than simply to hug your resources to yourself. If we look at verses 1 and 2, cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it again. Give portions to 7, yes to 8, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. Cast your bread upon the waters can refer to being what would you say, enterprising, because if you cast your bread on the waters, you don't know where they're going. It can also refer to being generous to people. If you give generously, there's no guarantee that you'll ever get it back. But we must be generous. Also in the second part, give portions to seven, yes to eight. Again, it's talking about being generous. For you do not know when you may need to depend on the generosity of others in the future. And that harks on to what our Lord says in John chapter 12, verse 25, when he says, the man who loves his life will lose it. If you want to keep it all to yourself, you'll end up with nothing. And this will be true in one degree or another, whether Colette is speaking of business ventures or pure generosity. In verses 3 and 4, he says the following, if clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there will it lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. Sometimes the clouds are full of water when we don't need any water or any more rain. We've had enough. Or sometimes the clouds fill with water and fall on us exactly when we need them. We just don't know. And when a tree decides to fall, a tree in your garden, it might fall in your house, it might fall in the neighbor's house, it might fall on no one. We just don't know either. This may start us thinking of maybes and might have beens, but our business is to grapple with what actually is. And few great enterprises have waited for ideal conditions, and nor should we. Verse 5, as you do not know the path of the wind or how the body, in other versions it says, the spirit comes to the bones, mentioning the spirit rather than the body, in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. This relates to the realm of the unknown and the unknowable of God. God makes everything. Our God who makes everything, the forming of the body in the womb, the forming of the spirit, when he puts the spirit in the body in the womb, is an example of God's crowning work. It's the marvel of the human body and the human spirit. And did our Lord have this in mind when he was speaking to Nicodemus in John chapter 3? The wind and the spirit, the same word in biblical languages, representing hiddenness and freedom from our control. John 3:8 says, the wind blows where it pleases, you hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. That was when Jesus was explaining the mystery and the miracle of salvation to Nicodemus, told him he had to be born again. These things are hidden from us, and they're free from our control, but they're powerfully real nonetheless. Verse 6, sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. The true response to uncertainty is a redoubling of effort. New Testament concepts are reflected here when Paul tells us to make the most of the time in Ephesians chapter 5. Make the most of every opportunity. Paul tells us to be urgent in season and out of season. Colette here is talking about the farmer. Paul is talking of the harvest from the good seed of the gospel and our works of mercy. And this should stimulate us. Here there's no sign of faltering. It's a question of boldness, not bravado or irresponsibility. The smallness of our knowledge and control, the likelihood of hard times, are reasons to show some spirit, not just to give up. And so we move on to the next point. Now the delights of life are not opiates to tranquilize us, but they are invigorating gifts of God. Point two, be joyful. Verse 8. However many years a man may live, let him enjoy all, but let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything to come is meaningless. So we have the delight of existence on the one hand, and the seriousness of existence on the other hand. Each joy in life is confronted by its opposite or its complement. Here, the author doesn't soften the colours of life. He portrays it the way it is. And this wonderful expression, light is sweet. Youthful radiance may last to the end of our lives, but not beyond, according to the author. He insists, by themselves, time and all things temporal will disappoint us because we have eternity in our hearts. Light gives way to darkness, the undoing of everything under the sun. We must face this fact or be shattered by it. But in verse 9 we read the following. Be happy, young man, while you are young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things God will bring you to judgment. So another aspect of joy is its relation to doing what is right. We read this text and it may seem that we're looking at a kind of sword of Damocles that's hanging over us, trying to rob us of the relish of joy. However, when the text says the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, it's talking about perfect freedom. And perfect freedom must have a goal worth reaching. Perfect freedom must have a well done to strive for in order to find fulfillment. Because otherwise, triviality takes over, or even worse than triviality, vice. If God judges us, it's because our ways matter to him and therefore are meaningful. And if our lives are meaningful, then we can have real joy. Actually, verse 10 follows this thought. So then banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. This is not escapism, nor an attempt to squeeze pleasure from a pointless situation. It makes more sense if it is enlarging on the invitation to the young man to rejoice in verse 9, but to rejoice responsibly. To idolize youth and to dread the loss of youth is disastrous. It spoils the gift even while we have it. Instead, we should see it as something beautiful in its time, but not beyond it. We move on from youth. And if we realize that we move on from youth, then we'll be free from frustration. The text talks of anxiety, vexation, a bitterness provoked by a hard and disappointing world. It's a tradition in Hebrew poetry to repeat things with different words. Banish anxiety from your heart. Cast off the troubles of your body, just for extra emphasis. But also there's a moral lesson in the second part, because the word troubles can also be translated evils. So young people are being encouraged to flee from evil and to do good. Enjoy youth, enjoy your time as a young person, but be responsible and flee from evil. Because joy was created to dance with goodness. Point 3, be godly. So at last we're ready to look beyond earthly vanities to God who made us for himself. The title Creator is well chosen. In Ecclesiastes 3:11, we see that the Creator sees the whole picture. He knows everything. In 7:29, his was the workmanship that we spoilt by our devices. Schemes is the word 7:29 uses. And now in 11, chapter 5, his creativity is continuous and unsearchable. When he says in chapter 12, verse 1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Remember here is not simply a mental act. Oh, I must remember. It's much more than that. It is to drop our pretense. It's to drop our self-sufficiency and commit ourselves to Him. It's passionate fidelity. It's intense loyalty. If this is remembrance, there can be no half measures. And it is in this spirit that we are made to face once more the fact of our mortality. And to reinforce this, there's a very long treatment of the subject which comes later. It's beautiful in its sequence of word pictures, but is a little bit long. At the beginning and ending of the passage, there are ideas without metaphors. If you look at verse 1, we said, the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. That's not a metaphor. That's clear speaking. And in verse 7, it's the same thing. And the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. That was God's sentence upon Adam in Genesis. To dust you shall return. But in the middle, we have a profusion of images which evoke old age and death. But really, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. Verse 2 is a somber scene. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grew dark, and the clouds return after the rain. Talks about a fading of our mental and physical powers, and perhaps the more general desolation of old age. As we get older, our friends are taken from us, familiar customs change, and long-held hopes are abandoned. This is the final stretch. When you're younger, the clouds might come, things might happen, but you always hope for improvement, and normally improvement comes. But in the final stretch, there is no improvement. The clouds come, and they gather again, and they gather again. And what Lynn mentioned before, so it is in youth, not in age, that these inexorable facts are best confronted. It's better to confront all of this when you're young, because it can drive us into action. It can drive us to that total response to God, which is the subject of verse 1. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. And it will not drive us into despair and vain regrets. Verses 3 and the first part of verse 4. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they are few, and those looking through the windows grow dim, when the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. It's a great house in decline. Our bodies are compared to a great house just falling to pieces little by little. And you can kind of guess which parts of the body they're talking about when the grinders cease. Those looking through the windows grow dim. So I suppose as we get older, our eyesight fades. Mine definitely. If I had my other glasses on, I wouldn't be able to read this. Our teeth fall out. Lots of things happen to us. Let's move on to verse 4b, birdsong. Both Roger and I are interested in birdsong. When men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. That's speaking to us of deafness, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever been up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning listening to birdsong. The morning song, the morning chorus. It's a wonderful experience. And just to think of not being able to hear it frightens me. Here, the cheerful evidences of a living world about us grow remote and faint, and one feels no longer fully part of it. I remember my father-in-law in his final years, he was quite deaf. It was very difficult to maintain a conversation with him. And he was a man who always enjoyed a good conversation. And deafness in old age isolates us. There's no question about it. Verse 5. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and the desire is no longer stirred, then man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Cluster of thought-provoking metaphors concluding in a funeral procession. As we get older, we worry about getting jostled and falling over. The almond blossom refers to our hair turning white, if we have hair to turn white. The grasshopper speaks of our loss of agility. And the question of desire, apparently, in the Hebrew, it refers to the caperberry. It says the caperberry fails. And the caperberry was a powerful aphrodisiac. So, the speaker mentions our eternal home, finality. And in this context, it's not really the Christian prospect of heaven. It's the end. Verse 6. Remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well. This captures how the beauty of the human frame, because the human body is a masterpiece of creation, with age turns fragile and becomes useless. It's the image of a lamp falling and shattering into pieces. The lamp falls because the silver cord is severed. Then there's the shattered pitcher at the spring, the broken wheel at the well. The well is abandoned because there's no way of getting water out of it. It's a reminder of who we are and where we're going. And that's why in verse 8, the preacher finishes as he began. Vanity of vanities. Meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. But on the final straight, let's not lose hope. If we jump, verses 9 through 12 are wonderful verses, but we're going to jump to verse 13. Verses 9 through 12 remind us of the teaching or the fact that our Lord Jesus Christ was a wonderful teacher also. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. That makes us think of our Lord's teachings. But in verse 13, now all has been heard, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. This chapter has set us on a path. And Ian was talking about a path this morning. This chapter has set us on a path that points to God. Here is the goal we were made for. The eternal towards whom the eternity in man's mind was meant to home and gravitate. For this is the whole duty of man. Which means this is all there is to man. The word all stands in stark contrast to the vanity with which the book has been confronting us. Here at last we find reality and we find ourselves. When the text asks us to fear God, it's in the sense of servants reporting to their master. It's also in the sense of putting us in our place and all other fears and ambitions in their place. Fear God. That's the priority. Forget all your fears about death and illness and old age. Fear God. That is the key point. Verse 14 drives home the point sharply. Verse 14 jolts us out of our apathy and kills complacency. Nothing escapes God's notice. Everything is assessed. Everything we do is looked at because God cares so much for us. And so nothing that we do can be pointless. Nothing is insignificant. Nothing is meaningless. This idea colours Christ's teaching also. He talked about sparrows and the importance of a sparrow. He talked about a cup of cold water, water that he would give and people would never thirst again. He talked about the importance of one repentant sinner. One was enough. So nothing is meaningless. Everything has meaning to God, and we are important to him. Colette has no intention of saying any more on the subject. He's finished. This is as far as he goes, because this is as far as he knows. And of course, he hasn't got the complete picture, as we have. And he would no doubt be delighted with the words of Paul, as we are, which serve to conclude this study of Ecclesiastes. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 54 and 58, says the following. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Therefore, my dear brothers, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain.